Hi, I'm John Bearer, the host and lead researcher for Stories of Sacrifice, American POW-MIA podcast, and the U.S. POW-MIA Family Locating, a free forensic genealogy public service I provide to support POW-MIA families trying to get their loved one identified and brought home. First, I want to thank you, our listeners, for your interest in the Stories of Sacrifice podcast. Our goal with the podcast is to tell the world about the sacrifice these brave heroes gave for the freedoms we enjoy every day. They gave our country their last full measure. They give us their tomorrow for our freedom today. Second, we would like to raise public awareness that thousands of these heroes from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War have still not yet been found or returned to the United States, with many still buried as unknowns in our own national cemeteries, their families still waiting for our government to disinter and identify them. So what can you do to support this important mission? First, if you are a relative of a missing in action service member, you can visit the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency website for more information about providing a family reference DNA sample. If you want more information, you can also contact me at john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Even if you're not related to an MIA, you can contact your members of Congress to request they allocate enough funding to support the POW-MIA mission and to change the DPAA policy to a DNA lead process and create additional public partnerships to disinter and process the remains for those that are buried as unknown. You can also help us in our mission by sharing these podcast stories with your friends, family, and consider sharing them on your own social media. We would also appreciate if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit www.storiesofsacrifice.org and leave us a review there. You can visit our affiliate links on our website where we will earn a small commission on your purchases and no extra cost to you. If you feel moved to do so, please visit our donation links on our website to help us continue this important mission. Just sharing these stories helps us greatly, and we cannot thank you enough for listening. Sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy today's show.
Gentlemen, I'm speaking to you tonight at a very serious moment in our history. The cabinet is convening and the leaders in Congress are meeting with the president. The State Department and Army and Navy officials have been with the president all afternoon. In fact, the Japanese ambassador was talking to the president at the very time that Japan's airships were bombing our citizens in Hawaii and the Philippines and sinking one of our transports loaded with lumber on its way to Hawaii.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Over 75,000 service members are still listed as missing in action from World War II. Of those, over 30,000 are currently listed as active pursuit by the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency. Active pursuit meaning they could possibly be identified with the proper family reference sample DNA being on file with the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The process of donating DNA reference material is easy, painless, and free of charge. If you are the relative of a missing service member, you can contact the Service Casualty Office of the MIA for information on how to provide a DNA sample. The Service Casualty Office will mail to your home a DNA donor kit that contains a donor consent form, instruction form, 3 cheek swabs, and a shipping envelope. All you have to do is fill out the paperwork, rub the inside of your cheek with the swabs, place the swabs back into the containers, and affix the label. The collected samples are then placed in a pre-addressed and prepaid envelope and then mailed to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab at Dover. That's it. It's a completely painless process. To get more information about your missing in action relative, you can visit our website, uspowmiafamilylocating.com. And we can help you to determine if your relative is currently listed on the DPAA active pursuit list and the next steps to help get them identified. Just visit our website or email john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com.
It was called the Death March not because of how many died. Of the 12,000 Americans, only about 1,700 lived to come home. But they called it a death march because of the way they died. If you stopped on the road, you were killed. If you had a malaria attack, they killed you. If you had to stop to defecate, they killed you. If you just couldn't take another step, they killed you. And how did they kill you? They'd either bayonet you to death, shoot you, or in some cases, decapitate you. They did not give us water. They gave us no food. The temperature was about 108 degrees. The Americans that were captured, a good 80% of them had malaria. Another 50% had dysentery. So we were gunshot wounds, malaria, dysentery, and we had to walk this distance that they wanted us to. Under these conditions, it was unbearable.
Most people remember that Pearl Harbor was bombed early one Sunday morning, which meant that it was still nighttime in the Philippines. But when the sun came up in the Philippines, 9.5 hours later, here came the Japanese bombers and their fighting planes. And would you believe that just like they caught all of our ships at Pearl Harbor, in the harbor, and sunk most of them, would you believe that they caught all of our airplanes on the ground, destroying most of them? And there were thousands of American troops and also about 32,000 Filipino troops. People ate monkeys, they ate snakes, they ate lizards, and ate just about anything that that they could find. Essentially what we were living on was a slice of bread made out of rice flour covered with a gravy made out of water and rice flour. So we were essentially starving to death. After our front lines broke, everybody was told to report back or fall back to the tip of the peninsula at a place called Cap Cabin. And once we got there, that's when we were told that we'd be being surrendered and for everybody to destroy all of their arms and ammunition, which is what we did. They lined us up, they counted us, and then started us out on what is now known as the Death March. There was only one road out, and the minute we started marching out of that one road with guards on either sides of us, that's when we started running into the Japanese troops that we'd been fighting for 4 months. And of course, the first thing they did was they stole everything we had. They took our wallets. They took our anybody that had a ring. They took our ring. They took our dog tags, and they emptied our musette bags on the ground and picked out whatever they wanted. And then once they had taken everything that we had, and as we kept going through these frontline Japanese troops, That's when they began to beat us. They beat us with rifle butts. They beat us with sabers. They beat us with clubs and anything they could get their hands on. And anybody that had a helmet, steel helmet on their heads, they knocked it off with a rifle butt. And that went on all day long. Even though we went by numerous artesian wells, water coming out of a 4-inch pipe, constantly flowing, no more than 20, 25 feet from the road, they wouldn't let anybody have a drink, nor did we, they let us rest. Of course, they didn't feed us. We did stop that first night, and they surrounded us with guards, with machine guns, but didn't give us water, didn't give us food, but at least we were getting rest. Next day, they got us up at the crack of dawn, and we started out on the same road, again running into Japanese troops. And once again, day two was just like day one, constantly being beaten every time we ran across the Japanese. And then I think it was around the middle of the second day that people began to collapse. You know, we hadn't had water in a day and a half, and in the tropics, it's almost beyond what you know what you can take. And of course, once anybody collapsed, the Japanese immediately killed them, and it looked like the Japanese were really trying to kill us all. It took me 5.5 days to get to the first camp. And then the Japanese commander got up and laid down the rules of the camp and said that if any were broken, the person would be shot, which is the words that we expected to hear. And but finally, he was speaking through an interpreter. An interpreter said that you have come here to die. And I thought that was a pretty severe statement. It didn't take us long to realize that he was telling the truth, because nobody knows exactly how many people died on the march, Americans. For the Filipinos, it was in the thousands. The Americans, the numbers vary from as low as 800 or 900 to as many as 2,000. And but within the first 40 days of our being in the first camp, Camp O'Donnell, another 1,800 Americans died.
Then we got taken prisoner, mm-hmm. And that's when the hell started. After we was taken prisoner, then we had to march 4 abreast. Somebody said it was about 100 miles, no food, no water. It took 7 days on that march, and up to Camp O'Donnell. And there was part of the way we rode on a train, not too far. And over there, there was all around 40, 50 dead every morning. Well, the Japanese, he got up on the platform there and he made a short speech. And we had to all be sitting and listening, and he said, you are our enemies. All we're interested in every morning, how many living, how many dead. And that was it. And I don't know how long we stayed over there, probably a year or two. Then we moved. They moved us to Camp Cabana de Chuan, and there I stayed until we were called for the roster in at Manila, Bilibid Prison. And they sorted those out there, and what I understand, there was 1,805 American prisoners. They put on this ship, was called the Harrison Maru. And my understanding was we were on this ship for 14 days, and nothing to eat to speak of, and no water to drink, and it was dark, you couldn't see nothing, and it was hot down in the hold where we were, and we were packed in shelves the way, you know, about 3-foot shelves, and that's where I stayed. And until the torpedo hit, the American submarine torpedoed the ship because it wasn't marked. It should have had the Red Cross sign, but they didn't have it, put it on there. So, and after the ship, before the ship sunk, I got out of there, so somebody opened the hatch covers, and we've got some light down there, and then I got out of there, and there was no Japanese on this ship. The ship was sinking slowly. It was broke in half, and I headed for the Japanese kitchen, and I ate all the rice and fish I could hold, and I even ate up a whole canteen cup full of sugar. And I put a life preserver on, and it slid off the ship, and I see a lot of them, they swam up. We were in a convoy of 13 ships. That's what we were told. And they threw a rope apron over the side of the ship, and they arrested their own people, the Japanese. And a lot of Americans climbed up, and they used poles, and they poked them in the eyes and got them off of there. And I seen what was happening. I never even swam close to it. I swam off by myself. And this was all about 5 o'clock in the evening when this ship was torpedoed, and then it wasn't too long, it was dark, and I must have swam for about 5 hours, I figured, and moon was shining, and when the boat drifted over the path of the moon, and you could see down the water, and a guy was in this boat, and he happened to see me, and I seen him, and he hollered, "Swim for it." Well, I tried, and I got so close that we could touch fingers, and I had to give it up. And about 3 attempts like that, and while I was swimming, I bumped into something. It was a board, about 12 inches long, 5 foot long, wreckage from the ship, I guess. And then I laid my body on that, and then I started swimming, and I made it. The guy took a hold of my hand, and that's all I remember. I must have passed out, I guess. And the boat was plumb full of water, so I laid on the seat there when I come to. And so there was, by then there was 3 of us in this lifeboat. Somebody else got in there too. There was a guy from Baltimore, Maryland, Robert Overbeck. And then during the night, we heard something bumping against his boat, and that was the mast for that boat, about 25 foot long, I guess, 5 inches in diameter. It had a pulley on top where you put a rope through it, and that was the mast for that boat. And we pulled that in and laid that on the side inside the boat. And pretty soon it was more bumps there.
And they caught all our planes on the ground, our B-17s. It was really sad to walk out in the runways and see these airplanes all crumpled up, melting aluminum around the engines, and knowing that we didn't have an Air Force there anymore. But we did get some down to Mindanao. We were down at Mindanao. We were shipped down to Mindanao on a little boat called the Mayan, a 5,000 tonner. And on the way down, we were hiding in one place off Negros Island. And a Japanese four-engine patrol boat, the type that can land on water, they spotted us, and they circled us a couple of times, and then they went out and made another turn to begin a bomb run. And they made four passes over us and dropped six bombs. None of the bombs hit the ship. The closest one probably hit the Mayan about 30 feet off the front left bow of the ship and made a big dent in the ship, which incidentally we had loaded the day before at Marvelous with boxes of dynamite because they had a lot of work to do to build the runway up down on Mindanao. So we were ordered to leave the boat, jump overboard with life preservers and swim for shore. Well, this wasn't so bad. I was making the shore pretty good, but there was one guy, his name was Baldonado, and he was from New Mexico. But he was being pulled out. The tide was going out, and he was being pulled out to sea, and he kept calling, "Help me, help me, help me." He had a life preserver on, and he had that World War I helmet on, and it was just sort of bobbing up and down above the water like it was floating. And he says, "Bob, help me." And I says, "Okay, I'll help you." So I swam over toward him. And when I got close to him, I said, "If you grab me, I'll leave you. Don't grab me." So I come up behind him, and we went a little ways just dog paddling. Finally, he says, "Bob, I think I'm all right now." So we paddled the rest of the way to the shore. But unfortunately, it was a shore that was covered. The water underneath the water was coral, and coral is very sharp, like a razor blade. So when we got to the sandy part of the beach, both of us, he had his shoes on, I didn't, and my feet were pretty well cut up by the time we got to shore. And we waited till sundown, and then everyone who abandoned the ship came back to the ship, and then we made the rest of the trip down to Mindanao. And we landed at a little barrio called Bugo, B-U-G-O, and it was a small dock for the Del Monte pineapple plantation. It was right next to the cannery that they used to can pineapple products with, and they'd load them on small boats and send them up to Manila, and they'd be distributed on other boats for markets around the world. And so that's where the Japanese invaded, and that's where I was when the Japanese invaded there. They made other invasions around the island, but that was one of them where they invaded.
My name is James Bolick. I spent 9 years in the service of the 9-6 was active, and of the active, 4 was spent overseas. And unfortunately, 3.5 of those 4 as a prisoner of the Japanese. And I joined the Army in 1940, and in 1941 took part in the Louisiana maneuvers, where we trained with dive bombers. And just as soon as the maneuvers were ended, we were shipped overseas. And we arrived in Manila on November 20th, and 18 days later, we were already at war with Japan. And since we had no airplanes, there was no way in the world that we could stop the Japanese from making major landings on the island where we were. Since we couldn't stop them, then everybody was told to assemble on the Bataan Peninsula. It was a small finger of land at the mouth of Manila Bay. It was about that time that the Japanese brought in a whole bunch of new troops. Everyone was told to fall back to the tip of the peninsula. And when we got there, that's when we were told that we were being surrendered. Finally, the Japanese came in. They counted us and started us out on the road out. All day long, we marched. The Japanese wouldn't let us have their water, and they didn't give us any rest. And most of the day, it was constantly being beaten. It just looked like they were trying to kill us all. And in my mind, there was no doubt about it. It took me 5.5 days to get to the first camp, which was Camp O'Donnell. We were met by General King and the Japanese camp commander. It was such a change, you know, being free and then going, being under the control of the Japanese. And it was hard mentally, but then you finally had to make up your minds, you know, do I want to fight this or do I want to survive? And to me, I wanted to survive. I figured I didn't want to die.
Most pancake syrups contain artificial flavors, artificial colors, and high fructose corn syrup. But there's an all-natural option free of additives in the same aisle. Real maple syrup from Canada is made from one ingredient. So turn the bottle and check the label. Is your syrup real maple? 100% pure maple, straight from Mother Nature herself. One ingredient, one source, one flavor. Pure maple from Canada.com.
Hey, Washington, D.C. We all miss the cheers.
The tears.
And the touchdowns.
The excitement of a last-second field goal to get the heart pumping.
The football season's finally here.
So now is the time to head to Hollywood Casino at Charlestown Races
to place your bets for Week 8.
And placing your bets at the sportsbook at Hollywood Casino Charlestown Races
is an easy way to earn exciting My Choice rewards all season long.
At the sportsbook at Hollywood Casino Charlestown Races.
All gaming is regulated by the West Virginia Lottery. Gamble too much? Call 1-800-522-4700 for free confidential help. Must be 21.
Our food was nothing but a handful of cooked rice a day, and when they didn't give us rice, they gave us boiled carrot tops, not the carrots, but the tops, which we couldn't eat because they were too bitter. And they also gave us boiled sweet potato vines that were edible and probably a lot better than the rice that we were getting. And the barracks that we stayed in was nothing but made out of bamboo with a thatched roof, no doors, no windows. At night, the mosquitoes would chew us alive. I think within the first 3 or 4 weeks, we had 3 guys that escaped. It's hard to call it escaped because all we had around the camp was, at that time, was barbed wire with Japanese guards walking around to make sure nobody got out. So it was fairly easy to get out if you wanted to in the dark. So 3 guys tried it. But instead of getting caught going out looking for food, and I don't even know if they ever got any, they were caught coming back in. And of course they were tortured for couple of days. They were put in a cage near the entrance to the camp, and then 2 days later, late one evening, everybody was called out,
to watch them where they'd already dug their graves, and they were executed by the Japanese. They took us to Manila, they put us in a boat, and a thousand to a hold. There was a hold in front and a hold in back. And we were cramped like sardines. At night they would close the hold. It was completely dark, and they'd be crying and screaming and praying. And invariably in the morning, when the Japanese would open up the hole, there'd be one or two POWs that died, and we'd just hand them up to the Japanese, and the Japanese would throw them overboard. And finally, things got so bad in the boat that we finally stopped at Taiwan, Korea. They took us off the boat, hosed us down. Now, that was about 7 months from the time that we had surrendered, and we were still in the same clothes that we surrendered with. And that was the first water we had on our bodies in all that length of time. We got back on the ship in our wet clothes. The ship was dripping wet. And unfortunately, I came down with pneumonia. We were on that ship for 32 days, and finally it docked. And instead of docking at Japan, it docked at Busan, Korea. They'd gone all the way up to Mukden, Manchuria, one of the coldest places in the world. And that's where I stayed until the war ended. But finally, you heard that the war was ending. An armistice had been signed between the fighting parties. I was on my way home. I stopped in Crowley, which was the nearest town to where I lived.
On the 19th and 20th, the ships arrived in Lingayen Bay, so we were being invaded. But now we are standing out there about 15 or 20 of us, and we looked at each other and we said, you know, we're at war. And that was really touched me. And I had problems coming from a Christian family of even thinking about killing anybody. And I thought, boy, this is going to be tough, because even though we're ordnance, we probably would be faced with that. And when we were told that there was close to 100,000, they estimated 100,000 troops, Japanese troops, that it would be, we would have a rough time. I was carrying a BAR and was trying to find some of my men to get them and round them up and so forth and take them, get them out of there. And a Jap jumped out of the bushes and lunged at me with his bayonet. His bayonet caught the shoulder strap of the BAR and the latch to the stock. It hit that little clip, and with the force that he had, pulled it out of my hand, and he's right by the side of me. So I grabbed him and pulled him to me, and I took my hunting knife and I stuck it in him and stuck it all the way through him and a little bit into me. And in other words, and I didn't know, and it went evidently right below his rib cage, but anyway, and that was a hunting knife with a pretty good sized blade. And so I thought, my best thought was, I don't know where I killed him or not, so I'll just drag him over here to the bluff and throw him off the bluff. And the way I threw him off, it was about 500 foot, so I drug him over and threw him off that bluff. We would hear Tokyo Rose telling us no reinforcements were on the way. And we would hear the Voice of America station at Corregidor telling us that there were reinforcements coming. We then, with a few men that we had left that were able to fight and all, and the 31st Infantry, we took that time to sort of get ourselves together and plan what we was going to do. So we held them another 2 months. We had heard some trucks and tanks, And as we got down to the road, we would have to go down to Marvellous airstrip where we were supposed to report to. The tank came on up behind us. And behind that tank was some more soldiers with some other prisoners. And we marched down, and this was getting late in the afternoon, to the Marvellous runway, where they had them all lined up there. And we lined up and spaced out like hand to hand. We stood there, and they looked at everything we had, and they took whatever they wanted, took the watches, and they took all kinds of things. And they took our canteens and poured the water out and gave us the canteen back. And then we saw some guys that had some things were Japanese. And they just took them and pulled them out back, and you could hear them shooting them out back. And so we started a march. And it was late in the afternoon, sort of late. It wasn't sundown yet, it was getting late. And we marched that night. And the next morning, it got on over, and we were just coming out of the mountains. And the picture that was taken by the Japanese was taken that morning. We were devastated. And here we realized that we had been captured. And we realized that these people were beating and killing people. Everything that we get now, we've got to be strong to sustain life. And as we walked down that hill, it was sad times with us. And we looked over at our flagpole, where our American flag was flying, had been all the time when we go out there. And there was a Japanese flag flying. And I'm telling you, that was sinking time, hard times for me. I thought about home. I thought about everything and the possibility that could happen to me, not knowing where we were going, the uncertainty and everything. It was really tough.
Did they give you any sense as to?
No, we didn't know. All said we are moving.
Right.
See, when we surrendered, the Japanese are so confused.
Right.
They start banging us in the head, bang, mud, shoving us. They're funny. They got us straightened. We marched out and calmed the force.
Right.
That day, the heat was so hot, 104, 105 degrees. You know, you can't, if you have malaria, by golly, you get some of the heat, you're going to feel it.
Right.
That's what happened. So out we went. Then start all the deaths going down. I've seen my buddy, Luther McAvey, he fell down, boom, boom, they shot him, and McKenzie, they clubbed him. I've seen Colonel Ball get hit in the head. There's one spot, one of the soldiers fell in a hole. I got that mentioned in the book here. Fell hole, the Japanese guards, they brought two of the men over. They told two of our men, bury him. They refused because that soldier was alive yet.
Right.
Then they ended up shooting the whole three. I told about the tank crashed into the guy's arm, I see. That's rough, but the roughest part was hitting camp.
Right.
See, when we, after death march is over,
and the actual death march itself was about 6 days, right?
You're right.
6 days.
Yeah.
And you ended up at Camp O'Donnell?
No, first we hit San Fernando. Temperature was 108 degrees that day, steel boxcar. They put 100 men each boxcar. Men suffering, screaming, we need air, we need air. If a man died, he couldn't fall down.
Right.
Then from there, about 4 or 5 hours later, it's train stop. We got in Capiz. One thing is, I want to thank the Filipinos. The men, women, children rushed out there with food, water, bananas, eggs to give us. We was the carving heroes to them people.
Right.
But Japanese ended up beating them, hitting clubs, chasing them away. Definitely we end up at But the campus, now we had to walk another 8 miles towards camp. When we got to camp, we looked and said, oh my God, no. NEPA shacks, roofs leaking. We had to stand at attention. Imagine after all them days without water, we had to stand at attention near a spigot, waiting for the Jap commander to come in there. Finally came up there. He said, I hate all you Americans. You're not going to like it here. Then released us, 100 men to camp. The bamboo slats was a bunk that cut right at the split bamboo cut in the back. We didn't have no blankets or mosquito bars, not like that. Our biggest trouble was men defecating all over the place there. Then we started losing 20, 30, 40, 50 a day.
You were there until really February of 1945, right? About 1,000 days you were in captivity. How did you possibly keep your spirits up?
I don't know. In the books, I had a good sense of humor. I guess I'm one of these older guys that I was making out rumors where guys land on islands that wasn't even such islands. That's all they waited for news, and I give it to them. Well, actually, that book, Bob Wise Surgeon, you ever get that? And mentioned how I built up the famous Cairo Cafe, so the men wouldn't eat out in the rain no more. So I've been the lean-to till I need my shack, see? Well, that's all they go around. What's the latest? If somebody tell the rumor and the other guy says it's not true, he almost got beat up. They wanted that good news, see? And that's what we live for. But for I'm saying, I was that way. If I gonna get it, I'm gonna get it. If I go up heaven, the Lord said, you're not wanted here. Then if I go downstairs to the devil, he don't want me either. So where am I gonna go? I gotta be somewhere, right? Well, they depend on me because I'm the older fellow, you know.
Right.
See, a lot of boys got there, the Nazi Guard kids, all young kids.
Right.
You know, and here I'm one of these older men there. They try to be hard because if they see they were probably treating the Americans good, they go to front lines. That's what they want.
How did you get news? Did you get any sense of what was going on? Radio, was there any communication at all?
We didn't have no radios or nothing, Cap.
While there, did you ever entertain any thoughts of just trying to bolt, leave, run away?
Let me explain this to you. A lot of us could have got away. But if one man escaped, they shot the other 9 men. It was my job to keep men from escaping. We had one man. They couldn't find him. Germany's guard got charged us with bayonets. We found that man by the latrine. The reason why he made 14 trips back and forth, and he said he got tired walking back and forth from his bunk to the latrine, so he lays right there, see?
The 6th Rangers show up in January of 1945. Did you know what was going on?
No, all we knew, when the shelling took place, we can hear it. Germans all took off, so we ran on our side. We stole the chickens, ducks, eggs, rice, so forth. We ate good. I gained 15 pounds before the Americans got in there, see? Mm-hmm. Then we heard the radio. We stole the radio. We heard the news coming in. In the meantime, Germany says, you're all going to die. Just as Americans get here, you're dead. So that way, we didn't know what was going on, and our biggest thrill was seeing the American planes fly over camp with the fighters circling like that. Then finally, boom, 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 boom. And that's when the Americans made the landing. Right. So when they hit camp, we didn't know, but a good thing they laid all night. They seen what camp the building was in. If then they could have got us in a crossfire.
As the first realization of liberty sank in, prisoners wept, shouted, laughed, sang national anthems, broke out hidden flags, snake danced. Rumors said enlisted men would get new Fords, NCOs Mercurys, officers Lincolns.
Our biggest trouble was we was 25 miles in Japanese lines. Seems funny not one Japanese tank or plane flew over the whole 10 miles route. Till early morning, one plane spots had come down this. I said, oh no, not now. Then he flipped his wing, then he sent a message. The next thing we had, it was like 14 planes coming in the circle, was protecting us, you know. But biggest trouble is when they hit the American lines, high on the hillside with the American flag, the man broke down crying, that flag went home. So I gave him a rifle. Hand me a rifle, my head right now. My thought was, I was worried about my wife and three girls. When I got them in the middle, they were okay. They're a little starving, but they came out of it okay. Then turned around.
Tell me about the reunion. At some point, you see your wife.
No, she said, what took you so long?
Humiliated in the Philippines in 42 and smoldering vengefully against the generals that had fought him there, tried to see to it that no great jurists, lawyers, or legal niceties impeded the judicially illiterate military tribunal he appointed. It was a race to execution under rough and ready rules of Class B and C trials.
In Manila courtroom, the Jap general who commanded in the Philippines during the infamous Bataan Death March stands trial. And here the noose tightens on General Hama. Jap brutalities are bared by witness after witness.
How did you get involved in one of the first military tribunal cases ever?
I wasn't invited. I was ordered by Joe MacArthur.
Right.
Well, as I says, I told you about how many guys didn't make the death march.
Right.
Well, during the trial, they asked the Americans how many died. Many, many died. How many? Many, many died. That's all they could say. Then after the trial, John said, go into Bataan, bring Abraham in. Sounds already blank of a ton. He said, you got to come in against the home of trials. At night, I had to interrogate the natives. They knew where the body was. They have to meet me in the morning, show me where the bodies were.
Mm-hmm.
I had to depend on 1,000 natives like that at night. Then I'd make reports and disinterment reports, and I'd make a map where I recover the body, see? So I wasn't interested in that, see? I wanted to get the job done and get the hell out of there. Japanese told the Americans, get into caves and tunnels. They did. They threw gasoline, hand grenades, and killed 137.
Mm-hmm.
To prove it to Japan, it's in the book here. I got every man mentioned who was executed right there. There's a lot of names in it, because all these names in that book, over 600 names, none of them guys came back to stay. I'm listening to all these guys say, said, oh, many, many died. So Major Skeen, which he was right beside Homer there. He came up and said, well, the first Homer looked kind of funny. I got there, all the reports got around me in newsreels. Lights came on, newsreels working on me. Homer, that's Major Skeen, who the hell's that guy? Well, the Major Skeen said, you don't like Krusty's guy. Do you want to say how many died? He said, I told you, established so far, many died. I said, sir, I'm not going to tell you nothing about death march. I'm going to tell you how many bodies I just interred. And I started telling three here, four there, so forth, and so forth. So that was it. Naturally, I'd be the only one happy actually testifying. The facts remain. I'm the one disinterred the bodies.
Right.
So who else got to be?
When you walk into the room for the first time and you see General Homa, that's the first time you'd ever seen Homa. You never saw him in any of your prison camps, did you?
No, that's during the trial. I says, never seen him.
Right.
I went to Homa tried for death of O'Donnell, not at camp, not on the death march.
Right. What did you think when you saw him? You walk into the courtroom for the first time?
Nothing. My mind is fog. I'm digging the body, so there's the guy there. I'll just say I'm like Yamashita showed that the hunger, but what was that? It was nothing but another bamboo trial.
Right.
Yamashita took his 100,000 men 100 miles up the hill to Baguio. Japanese Navy Marines wasn't under Homo's command. They raped and burned Manila. Mm-hmm. Who did it hang? Yamashita, 100 miles away in the hills, and them not doing it.
Right.
That's can't go. Just like it's, I'm the only man that ever knew this, because I heard it during a trial. There's a colonel came up to two lieutenants, and Major Skeen said, I don't want to defend Homo too good. But of course, they ain't gonna like it. Well, hell, he's already convicted even before the trial. I heard that. Good thing I was right there. See, that's what you call a kangaroo coat.
But Major Harold Homer, then Lieutenant General of the Japanese Imperial Army and Commander-in-Chief in the Philippines of the Armed Forces of Japan at war with the United States of America and its allies, did on 6 May 1942 unlawfully refused to grant quarter to the armed forces of the United States of America and its allies in Manila Bay, Philippines, and did thereby violate the laws of war. Upon secret written ballot, two-thirds or more of the members concurring, the commission sentences you to be shot to death with musketry.
Those rights really didn't exist in a military trial.
The American lawyers shanghaied for the defense infuriated MacArthur by bitterly challenging irregularities under American and international law at every step. Going all the way to the United States Supreme Court, they lost the appeal for Homa. But in a scathing dissent, Justice Murphy wrote, "The enemy has lost the battle, but destroyed our ideals." In Manila, the sentence was death.
Mrs. Homa went to Douglas MacArthur, pleaded for her husband's life. Now, MacArthur did not grant that wish, but he did change the method of execution.
Yamashita was hanged. Many of the other 5,700 B and C list prisoners were tried and executed within a week.
Well, you know, you served an unbelievable benefit to the families, so they actually, there's a record.
I wish the hell I had the clippings. I got clippings from Stars and Stripe, Acme, Telephone, from all over the world. Then all these mothers started writing to me.
Right.
I got one recently on email. She said, my great grandmother was worried about the body being scattered in the jungles. I wrote back to Nas and he died in Caban Juan on such and such date of dysentery. Now the guy said, he's going to Philippines. He said, is my brother's body there in the cemetery? I said, he is. Yeah. Well, I notified over 1,000 mothers. Hey, I'm one of the guests at the All-Star game.
In Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Hear this beautiful scene in front of you here at PNC Park. And right now, let's go to public address announcer Tim DeBacco.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, would you please remain standing? Here to honor America with the singing of our national anthem is two-time Academy of Country Music Award winner, Carrie Underwood.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight.
Thank you for listening to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II, American POW MIAs in the Philippines. This has been a production of the USPOW-MIA Family Locating. You can find us on the web at USPOW-MIAFamilyLocating.com. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and given in the best intention. Overall, the POW-MIA accounting community is doing what it can with limited resources. It is our hope additional federal funding will be provided, along with additional partnerships established to disinter and process the remains of our unknowns located in the national cemeteries. You can help by contacting your congressional representatives and asking that they implement a DNA lead policy for those unknown POW-MIAs. Thank you for listening.
Are you in excruciating pain brought on by your son, daughter, or spouse suffering from addiction? You are not alone. If you call Recovery Centers of America today at 1-888-RECOVERY, your whole family can begin to recover. At Recovery Centers of America at Capital Region and Bracebridge Hall, your loved one will be treated with care by expert addiction professionals, while family programming will give you support and healing so that you can recover as well. RCA accepts insurance, provides transportation, and offers intervention services. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Now.
So then I dropped some garlic and croutons on there, and the rest is salad history. I made the best salad ever, people, and now I'm making the best app. The Caesar Sportsbook app got live in-game betting, parlays, and Caesar rewards. Caesar salad ain't got nothing on my app. Nothing!
Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call, text, or chat 1-888-532-3500. Download the Caesar Sportsbook app. Your app is ready, Emperor.